time to tell me the truth, to burden your mouth for what you say, and pieces of paper in the way, 'cause I can't continue pretending to choose these opposite sides on which we fall, loving you later.
Hello, welcome to Between the Lines, a monthly magazine show on the third Thursday of every month at 2 p.m. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper. In this month's show, we examine the nature of addiction in a conversation with psychoanalyst, clinical social worker, family therapist, poet, writer and performer, John McInerney. John divides his time between his house in Athens, Greene County, and New York City, and his practice in Greenwich Village, where he treats many addicts in recovery. According to a recent study, heroin use is growing more common in the US, and recovering from the potentially lethal drug remains extremely difficult. A recent survey by the Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration found that the use of heroin jumped 102% between 2002 and 2012. And in 2012, about 669,000 people reported using heroin at some point in the year. We had actually recorded the interview the day before Philip Seymour Hoffman died of a drug overdose. And in light of that event, we both felt that the subject warranted more examination. And so we came together again. Much has been said and written and reported about the tragedy of Philip Seymour Hoffman's death and about his drug addiction, about the US drug laws, and including on this radio station about the situation in Greene and Columbia counties. In fact, addiction is a subject with so many angles, you could discuss it for hours. But John takes a more spiritual approach. What did you think when you heard that Philip Seymour Hoffman had overdosed?
Well, I think the first thing that went through my mind was just the terrible pain and isolation that comes with addiction, and the fact that that had won, which, you know, is a terrible, terrible tragedy for anybody, but particularly for somebody who has such a great talent and has contributed so much to the world. I saw Phil on stage in New York and saw him on screen, as many other people did. The devastation of that loneliness and fear and isolation that just takes over your life when you're an addict, and that addicts contend with every day. You know, they try to live with this terrible force that really is the centerpiece of their life. Their whole life is... You know, when you're an addict, whether it's heroin or alcohol or sex or, you know, nicotine or whatever it is. Your whole life is organized around that one substance, that one thing. It's organized around getting high. Even smokers, regular, you know, cigarette smokers experience this, you know, so on and so forth. Your whole life is punctuated by this and ordered and structured around the addiction. And that's the terrible thing about this issue is it's not so much the substances themselves, but the way that they completely take over your life. And that's what, it was the tragedy of that really struck me first when I heard about Philip Seymour Hoffman's death.
Now, would being in therapy have helped him? And what can therapy do for someone who's an addict?
From a clinical point of view, as far as the protocols for treatment are concerned, most people agree, in fact, the medical and establishment agrees, that addiction is what's called a primary diagnosis. So that if you have an addiction, that must be dealt with first before you deal with any other issues. And of course, we know that, you know, underneath addiction, there are a host of other issues for most people. But the idea is to treat the addiction first and then see what's left when you do that. And people in AA understand this. You know, your average alcoholic who is fortunate to end up struggling with staying sober, or your average addict who's fortunate enough to stay, to be struggling to stay clean, understands this, that, you know, that's the first thing you have to do. You know, in AA they say, just don't take a drink. You know, it's day by day, one day at a time. Just don't drink today, right? And with any addiction, it's the same thing. Just don't shoot up today. Just don't score. Have your fantasies about it. Do whatever you want to do about it, you know. Of course, you'll have the thoughts and the feelings and the impulses, but you have to learn to manage those. And good addiction programs help you because they provide you with a lot of support, a lot of understanding from other people who have been addicted themselves, so they know what they're dealing with. Sometimes medical support is necessary, as in, you know, prescription drugs and so forth. But a large part of the time, what really works with addiction treatment is the connections that you make with other addicts and the sense that you're not alone. You know, it's, again, I keep going back to this theme of isolation. And psychotherapy, of course, can help to break through that isolation as well. And it is recommended for a lot of people who are struggling with addiction. But for the most part, it's best when it comes after you've already gotten clean, and you're no longer an active user, right. And you're committed to maintaining your sobriety, mm-hmm. and you have the support of a group of other people who are in recovery. I certainly, as a psychotherapist, and I know other people as well who have worked with people who are active users and are struggling to get off. They don't want to go to a treatment program that's specifically for substance abuse. They don't want to take medication. They don't identify with the 12-step model. And, you know, that's fine. If you're committed to recovery, you don't want to use any of the models that are out there, and you can find a therapist who's willing to work with you. And as I said, I've done that on many occasions, and I know I have other colleagues who have. It's not the best way to do it. It's not the agreed upon way, that consensus supported way of doing it. But people can get clean on their own with a good therapist who knows what they're doing and understands the addiction process and the sobriety process. Yes, it can happen, but it's not the first line.
Now, Philip Seymour Hoffman was in rehab for 10 days last year, which now everybody's commenting on that wasn't enough. It does seem as if with addiction, you kind of have to be in some form of rehab for the rest of your life. British comedian Russell Brand, he said in a column in The Guardian, he said, the last time I thought about using heroin was yesterday. So it's a lifelong challenge.
It is, that's right. It's a lifelong challenge. And Russell was very clear about it in the article. You forwarded it to me and I read it. It was a very good article. He's very clear about the fact that drugs are not his problem, life is his problem. Life is what these people struggle with. Life is what we all struggle with. Some of us are better at it than others. Some of us have better at dealing with the rough and tumble of everyday life. But yeah, if you're an addict, you're constantly, you know, that's your solution. Nicotine is your solution. Heroin is your solution. Sex is your solution. So, you know, you put everything into this one container.
Yeah. You, not to interrupt you, but you just suddenly put me in mind of the British chef, Nigella Lawson, who just went through a very public divorce from Charles Saatchi. Right. And all these issues came up about her supposed drug use. She was using cocaine, she was using marijuana. And when asked if she had a drug problem, she said, no, I had a life problem, which I thought was very interesting.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's and I think people use it as a stress management tool. And, you know, the problem with that is, you know, so-called recreational use becomes as I said, using it for stress management purposes. And that's when you get into the fine line between substance abuse and substance addiction. Substance abuse is generally thought of as being just that, that you abuse substances as a way to manage you know, the ups and downs of everyday life, the stresses of life, because you have poor distress tolerance. And then addiction is when you absolutely structure your whole life around this addiction. It's a fine line, but it's a well observed line. And somebody like, you know, somebody like Nigella Lawson, and many of our friends that we may be able to think of who start out as recreational users of alcohol or recreational users of marijuana get to the point where they do use the drug as a way to shore themselves up and get through everyday life. And that's when it really gets to be a problem.
Right. But I also just want to make the point that there are many people whom we know do use drugs, certain drugs, recreationally, and have no problem whatsoever and are never going to go on to become addicted.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. And I think that's one of the reasons that we have such support for changing the marijuana laws, because there are many, many recreational users of marijuana out there who know quite clearly that marijuana is less harmful than alcohol, it's less addictive than alcohol, and, you know, it doesn't lead to domestic violence the way that alcohol does. You know, it doesn't lead to DWIs the way that, it doesn't lead to reckless loss of judgment the way that alcohol.
Now, to change the subject a little bit, I wanted to ask you, now, your practice is in the West Village.
That's right, yeah. Technically my practice is in the East Village because it's one block east of Fifth Avenue on University Place.
That's the dividing line.
So that's the dividing line. So, yeah. My practice, I have had a practice in the West Village, but I moved from just behind the Jefferson Library where I had... and I had an office there after the wonderful Lady Esther restored that building and got the bell working for us, which made a wonderful difference in the neighborhood. But then I moved a few years ago, well, it's more than a few, 12 years ago now, to University Place. So
you might even have been treating, you could have treated Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah, I could have. I mean, obviously I have, you know, if you have a practice in that part of the world, then you... you know, you're working with, and I'm working with a lot of artists. Some of them are some creative writers, some actors, some directors, people in the film and entertainment industry, of course. So yeah, Philip Seymour Hoffman is as a character in his own story, so to speak, is a very familiar character to me. And I've had people, many people who are in recovery, and some people who are still struggling with their use. And of course, it's tremendously rewarding when you help people to lead a more fulfilled life. But it's also tremendously saddening when you see somebody like Phil who, just crashed and burned. And you know, you asked me earlier on about a 10-day rehab. The implication of your question was whether that's enough in some ways. When I started off working in the West Village, and that was 25 years ago when I started a private practice in the West Village, we were getting people from places that were where they had been in recovery for a year and a half, sometimes 2 years. at an upstate facility, and they would come back to the city to a halfway house, and then they would come to us. We had a storefront clinic in the West Village. Those people would come to us for their psychotherapy after they got out. I was in charge of, I was the clinical supervisor for doing intakes there. My job was to meet people and do an evaluation and see where we could go and how we could help them and so on and so forth. But, you know, and a year and a half or 2 years of rehab really works. And some of these guys were tough, street-level heroin addicts, you know. They went on to, because of a very tough program, mind you, these guys went through a tough program that was run by other addicts, and they didn't get away with anything. And it was could sometimes be brutal. But when they came out, they were clean. I don't know what the recidivism rate was in those days, but I know the guys that I worked with, some of whom I'm still in touch with today, who went into banking and went into the stock market, and, you know, this kind of thing, got jobs in the financial industry.
Right, John, I think you make some terrific points. We're just going to take a short break here. You are listening to Anne Forbes Cooper on Between the Lines. I'm here with John McInerney, family therapist, and we're now going to listen to John Lennon's Isolation. Speaking of isolation.
It made. Don't they know we're so afraid? Isolation. We're afraid to be alone. Everybody got to have a home.
And we're here with John McInerney, who is a psychoanalyst, clinical social worker, and a family therapist. And he's going to talk today a bit about the nature of addiction. John, how many of your patients are addicts? I mean, what percentage of your practice could you attribute to addiction?
At the moment, right now, if you were to ask me, you know, how many people am I working with who are in recovery? I think probably somewhere in the region of about 20%. And I'd say that's been fairly stable figure throughout my practice in New York City. At one point, it was probably, it maybe rose to 15% because that's 5-0, because I was working, you know, I was mostly based in a clinic in the West Village. So we had a lot of people who were in recovery. and we had a you know, relationship with a number of different places that did drug and alcohol treatment. So we saw a lot of people coming in who were on their way to a halfway house from long-term treatment programs, some a year, some 2 years, you know. And we also had just had people wandering in off the street, of course. So it's been as high as 50%. It's probably down to about 20% now. You work in New York City as a clinician. You can't help seeing people who are in recovery. And in fact, you know, the trend has been within my profession over the last 15, 20 years has been towards allowing people in recovery more and more accessibility to psychoanalytic treatment, because there was a time when psychoanalysis wouldn't touch somebody in recovery.
Why?
Well, because, from a medical point of view, there wasn't any way to reach people if they were coming in stoned, you know. And also because they have a tendency to act out and, you know, sabotage the treatment very frequently. So from that point of view, it wasn't. And also, you know, psychoanalysis was a treatment that was kind of reserved for, you know, more middle-class, upper-middle-class people who had the financial resources to come to psychoanalysis 3 or 4 times a week, you know. That's changed a lot, and I think, you know, one of the reasons it's changed is because of insurance companies. It's one of the few benefits, I think, to, you know, health insurance that covers mental health. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that, not one of the few. There are many, but it's been a benefit of that. And and also because I think the recovery movement has grown so much. People are less ashamed now that they go to AA meetings or Al-Anon meetings. You know, people are much more willing to own the fact that they do have an addiction problem. They have a substance abuse problem.
But the other thing is that when I mean, we're roughly from the same era and we grew up roughly in the same country.
Yeah.
I grew up in Scotland, you grew up in Ireland.
Ireland.
I mean, then doing drugs was just a rite of passage. It was something you went through.
It was, yeah. And you know, if you were, you know, for most people, you went through it and you came out the other side, and it was just, that's just what you did, you know. And it was, of course, you know, I was 16 in 1969, you know. I mean, of course it was, there was a rite of passage. But so in that sense, it was kind of normalized as a behavior, although it was still not acceptable, you know, in the wider society. It's perfectly acceptable within our peer group. But in the larger society, it wasn't acceptable. Now I think what's happening is that addiction has become more and more labeled as an illness, you know, rather than as a behavior. So the underlying assumption, of course, there is that you can't help it, you know, that you have this illness, and so you know, you should have treatment for it. And in some ways, you know, we could argue that back and forth, and I could argue it with a number of peers who have different opinions about, you know, the illness model, and I'm not convinced of it either. But it does have the great advantage of allowing us to look at it in a more non-judgmental way. And I think that's a key to allowing people to come out of the closet after many, many years of suffering alone with their, you know, with their addiction or their abuse problem, is that society is much less judgmental of it now, you know.
And there has been some form of narcotic or something to become addicted to since the beginning of time.
Sure.
So
sure.
You could say it's just in our innate personalities to want to overdo something or go over the top. But in some of the best tunes, they say the devil owns the best tunes, but some of the best tunes have been written under the influence. And in fact, we're just going to take a quick break and listen to one of them now.
Great, great.
Thank you. just where I'm going. But I'm gonna try for the kingdom if I can, 'cause it makes me feel like I'm a man when I put a spike into my vein. And I tell you things aren't quite the same when I'm rushing on my run, and I feel just like Jesus' son. And I guess that I just don't know. And I guess that I just don't know. My life, 'cause when the blood begins to flow and it shoots up the dropper's neck, when I'm closing in on death, now you can't help me, not you guys or all you sweet girls with all your sweet talk.
Between the Lines, I'm Anne Forbes Cooper. I'm here with John McInerney, clinical social worker, psychoanalyst and family therapist.
You know, the idea of addiction is, you know, because it diverges, it diverges from the spiritual use of these kinds of things. So how does that, you know, how does that make it a bad thing, really? You know, these are things that everybody's been doing for tens of thousands of years. Why is it so different? Why is it so dangerous? You know, how does it get out of control? And there's a lot of research on that now in terms of brain chemistry and so on and so forth, which I don't know a whole lot about because I'm not a brain scientist. If I'm any kind of scientist, I'm a social scientist. I'm more interested in you know, the ideas behind it. And I think what happens is, you know, the difference between, and people still do use drugs now for spiritual purposes, even here in, you know, here in the West. In fact, some drugs are used as a treatment for addiction.
Such as, I mean, and what exactly do you mean by drugs are used for spiritual purposes? What do you mean by that?
Well, the whole idea of transcending, you know, the human condition, getting outside of the human condition, so that we can see beyond all the pardon me, all the pressures and the imperatives that we have in our everyday life, and see through to our true nature as living organisms, right?
Which is what the psychotropic drugs did, right? And Timothy Leary started.
Exactly, which is, you know, the whole Timothy Leary psychotropic medication and so on and so forth, just part of a spiritual...
Quest,
exactly, yeah. But, you know, the problem with that is that, you know, you get a lot of people who are vulnerable, who are in pain, and you give them psychotropic medication or any kind of drug that can get them out of that state of suffering. And now what happens is that they have this self-transcending experience, but they're just having the experience for the experience sake. The difference between the use of, say, ayahuasca, which is becoming, I won't say popular, but certainly there. I've had people in my practice who've had ayahuasca treatment.
What is it?
Ayahuasca comes from South America, and it's used in spiritual practices in South America. But it's used in a very it's a hallucinogen, but it's used in you know, pretty well regulated spiritual communities. So what's happening is that you're sharing your experience with other people, and other people are sharing their experience with you. And that's the key difference. You know, the biggest problem for me, and I suspect you could talk to other clinicians about this, but I suspect it would be fairly broadly true. The biggest problem I have in helping people recovering from addictions is the emotional and psychological and often social isolation that they live in, and actually getting through that isolation and bringing people into a relationship feels to them to be rewarding and valuable. That's the most difficult part, because people who are addicts have spent years trying to overcome their pain and suffering. And I've never met an addict, by the way, who didn't have a life that was filled with pain and suffering before they became addicted, you know. So, you know, I think that's, you know, with trying to get past that pain and suffering and the confusion of that and the feeling of not being able to function in the world is what frequently, I think, brings people to addiction, because they have an experience with the drug that transcends all of that stuff, and now they just want to repeat it and repeat it and repeat it. And that's part of human nature. It's that idea of repeating a good experience, you know, that is basic to all of us, but it really messes with the addict's life, because they have one source for their good experience, and that's a drug, not another human being, not a relationship, not satisfaction from work, you know, not dealing with the ordinary rough and tumble of everyday life and, you know, feeling good about yourself for being able to do that, but getting high or getting drunk or tripping out or, you know, whatever it is, that becomes the goal. And that's where the addiction starts to take over. Because it really, what it does is it isolates you from your essential humanity.
And is that one of the biggest challenges for a psychotherapist, finding something to replace that high with?
Well, usually when I, by the time I get people, for the most part, I've worked with some people who are, you know, still on the on the fragmented edges of playing with whatever substance that they're, you know, that they've been addicted to, but they're trying to like come off of it. They're making a really, you know, strong effort to come off of it. But for the most part, the people that I see are people who are actually in recovery. They've quit using, and they're struggling with their life now, you know, and just how to function, you know, in the world, which, you know, at some point involves getting a decent job, you know, feeling fulfilled in work and having a relationship, feeling fulfilled interpersonally, you know. Creating a, you know, creating a situation in which people feel safe enough to explore all the, you know, all the pain that's left behind when you pull the drugs out of the picture. That's the basic job of psychotherapy, is to help people to create that safe space for themselves within the relationship with you, you know. So yeah, I mean, that's what you want to try to do, because people don't feel safe, you know. They don't feel safe with themselves. They, you know, they're in recovery because they, as they say in AA, they've hit bottom, you know. And hitting bottom means, you know, you've lost it. You've lost everything. You've lost the dog, the wife, the car, the kids, the house, the job, you know, whatever your version of hitting bottom is. And maybe you just got fired, you know.
And they do say that people do have to hit that bottom before they can move on up again, before they can turn their lives around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do say that in the disease model, which is, you know, how the 12-step model is referred to. That's not true for everybody, and you know, there are lots of particularly young people now getting sober, looking at their lives anew after and using a 12-step program or some other harm reduction program to, you know, to help them engineer their way out of that, who haven't hit what, you know, your average 50-ish alcoholic would call bottom. You know, they've hit a wall in their own life.
Okay, and we are just going to take another break. And I'm Anne Forbes Cooper. You're listening to Between the Lines, and I'm here with John McInerney, who's a psychoanalyst, clinical social worker, and a family therapist.
1, 2, 3, 4. Some people get high on music. Some folks get high on life. Some girls get high by getting husbands. Some husbands get high when their wife's not looking. Some folks get high being downhearted. They love to moan and weep. Me, I get high on reefer.
Reefer!
Then I fall asleep. And I dream about an island in the Caribbean.
Holding hands.
Holding hands.
With you.
With you. Beside the sea.
Beside the sea.
And I wonder, do you dream about when you put that reefer in your mouth? In my dream, you dream, dream of me. Fall asleep with dreams. dream, you dream, dream. I wonder, what do you dream about when you put that reefer in your mouth? In my dream, you dream, dreamer.
And this is Between the Lines. I'm Anne Forbes Cooper. I'm here with John McInerney.
You know, the other aspect of just, you know, getting out of it, which is, you know, a term that's used to talk about, right? You know, I got really out of it last night. And so when you do that, you're disengaging, right? And with heroin, you know, with heroin, you're seriously disengaging. But that's the attraction of any drug. And not only drugs, but habits, you know, eating. You know, you were saying people get addicted to other things as well. We also get addicted to our thoughts. We get addicted to our feelings sometimes. You know, we have we want to have that feeling again and again.
Yeah. And I also think that a more acceptable drug, if you like, is alcohol, because it's not illegal. And I know many people who are basically, well, certainly coming from the UK, they are high-functioning alcoholics, basically. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really interrupt their daily habits or their lives, but they need alcohol every single day in order to function to a certain extent, in order to be sociable.
Oh, sure. I know lots of high-functioning alcoholics. I've had high-functioning alcoholics in my practice. Very high-functioning alcoholics, as a matter of fact. I mean, this is a problem when we take this very kind of homogenous view of addiction, is that, you know, we probably all know people who... I know people, for instance, who smoke weed every day. They do demanding work, you know. They run... They have a complex family life. And they do it all very well. You know, they smoke every day, maybe twice a day. And then I know other people couldn't begin to do that. If they had one toke, they're just out of it for the day. You know, they forget it. You know, just take them out of the picture. They can't function. So we really don't know much about what it is that makes one person be able to function, another person not be able to function. And frankly, you know, alcoholics and drug addicts are, when it comes to regulating society, various different attempts that our institutionalized world makes to do that, addicts are a pretty easy target. And of course, you know, one of the interesting comments that was made during the recent debate about stop and frisk before Mayor de Blasio got elected, and he actually ran on that issue, was, okay, so how about if we reassign the guys who are out in Brownsville, Brooklyn, doing stop and frisks, to Wall Street, and we stop and frisk all those guys who are going to work every morning with cocaine in their pocket, you know? And people were outraged at the idea.
It's such a great idea, especially after seeing The Wolf of Wall Street, you know?
Well, yeah. The whole discussion of drugs and so on, I think, you know, contextually... You always have to look at the context. You know, when somebody comes to me with a difficulty in their life, we don't just look at the difficulty. You look at the context. You want to know where they come from, how they, you know, what they believe in, how they grew up, and so on and so forth. And I think the same is true with issues like addiction. We want to look at the context. Why are we addressing this thing the way we are? There's nothing wrong with treatment programs. There just aren't enough of them. There's nothing wrong with AA. I'm not criticizing any of that. What I'm saying is, look, let's look at the context of this. Why do we put such an emphasis on this? Part of the reason is because we're always trying to regulate the world to make it easier and more comfortable for ourselves to live in. And when we see people suffering, like addicts, drunkards, you know, albeit that they cause a certain amount of damage to those around them, and they do, you know, there's no question about that. But when we look at them and we make them a target for all of these billions of dollars of effort to control this thing, you know, the drug war, which is one of the most ludicrous ways of spending money, what are we doing it for, you know? And are we missing the mark? Because at the same time as that's going on, we're, you know, in terms of damage that's being caused to society, there are other people out there who are causing far more damage to society because they're addicted to their ego, you know, and to, you know, Wolf of Wall Street, right? Mm-hmm. There are people like that who cause enormous damage to the world.
On the other hand, if you look at the Mexican drug cartels, then that's taking it to the other extreme too. That's a truly evil side.
That's taking it to the other extreme, yeah. Yeah, true evil, because it's about greed. You know, it's and this is, again, going back to, you know, the addict wanting to repeat that experience over and over again and creating that isolation. You know, one of the, you know, many, many addicts are very talented. Many people who recover from alcohol abuse are very talented people. And when they do make a recovery, they make a terrific contribution to the world. It's getting, you know, it's about sharing your brilliance with the world, being able to do that, being able to get out of that awful, painful situation where you're just, you're only thinking about yourself, you're only thinking about your own gratification, you're only seeking to get that high all the time. You're not sharing, you know, your insight or your wisdom with other people. And the drug cartels are feeding that greed. And of course, once they get onto it, then it becomes really, really desperately dangerous, vicious, horrible stuff, because they're willing to, you know, they're willing to kill hundreds of people in one go, you know, yeah. Decapitate people and bury them in the desert. You know, that's real craziness. And
you know, one of the things that interests me is not so much what people do when they stop being addicted, it's actually what they create or compose when they are addicted. I mean, some of the best poems, some of the best songs have been composed under the influence. And then there's if you think about Coleridge, who under the influence of opium, and wrote that wonderful poem Xanadu in Kubla Khan. Xanadu, did Xanadu Khan, a stately pleasure dome decree?
Yeah, you had it beaten into you in school too.
Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, you know, if Freud was a you know, self-confessed cocaine addict, you know. Well, I don't think he called himself an addict, but he definitely was.
Right, you know. And Jung and R.D. Lang, they all experimented with LSD.
Absolutely. Jung also experimented with other things as well. But this goes back to the spiritual tradition of drug use, doesn't it? Is where you're trying to transcend the human condition, and the human condition, according to the Buddha, and I think it's a pretty valid position, is, you know, suffering. That's our human condition. We suffer, you know. A friend of mine has a brother who's a medical scientist who does research, and his definition of a living organism is, you know, he deals with microorganisms, and when you ask him, well, how do you know they're alive before you do your experiment on them? And what they do is they put a small charge into them, and if they react, then they're alive. So his definition of a living organism is one that can suffer. So, you know, so how do we transcend that suffering? That's what we're always looking for and have been looking for from the beginning of time. And the idea that you can use drugs to do that, of course, has a lot of currency, because it's true. The only problem with it is that is temporary. It's a you know, you can't live in a state of transcending the human condition. You can live in a state of having much better distress tolerance than you have now. And that's what therapy is about for for all of us, not just for addicts. It's about being able to tolerate the distress of ordinary life and being able to connect to something in yourself and in other people that is very fundamental to our human condition, which is the stuff that we're not cognizant of all day long, not under pressure to do all day long, but the stuff that's just there in us, the marvelous, beautiful, wonderful thing of simply being a living organism who's alive in this world right now. Just that is transcendent. The opening tune for this segment is George Harrison's Within You, Without You. And one of the reasons I chose that is because, George was studying spirituality with the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi at the time, who he subsequently was, I think, disappointed in because he thought he was a bit of a fraud. But he did learn a lot, and that song is great because it talks about the essential teaching of all good spirituality, which is that there's something out there that's much bigger than you, and life goes on within you and without you, And the without part of that doesn't just mean whether you're there or not. The without part of it also means outside of you. And so that's really the key to it, is that, for all of us, whether we're addicted to our own ideas or whether we're addicted to a substance or whether we're addicted to just the fact that we're wonderful or whatever it is, the idea that life goes on outside of you as well and that you're part of this thing, that you're very small, which is also what the song says, is really important. We're just these little, we are like those microorganisms that my friend's brother studies. We're made up of microorganisms and cells, We have this thing that called consciousness that's kind of an accident in a way, sort of a happy accident. And we think that everything that goes on in our conscious mind is where it's all at. And it isn't. Everything that goes on in our conscious mind is a little, tiny little pinprick in the whole scheme of things. So the idea that life goes on within you and without you, I think, is a really crucial part of the message about life in general and also about addiction, is that, we're very small. And actually, the wonderful irony of it is that when we recognize that and we accept that we're very small and we can't control all of these things, there's actually a wonderful sense of release comes from that, because you can surrender. And when you surrender, you can really be fully human. And that's, I think, what the search for meaning through drugs is all about. It's all about trying to find your essential humanity and get beyond your immediate sense of life as painful and scary and confusing and filled with shame and embarrassment and all those other things that we all feel all the time anyway, whether we're drunk or sober.
And on that note, I just want to thank my guest, John McInerney, who will be a regular part of Between the Lines. And we've been talking today about addiction. And John lives in Athens. He's a psychoanalyst, a clinical social worker, family therapist, and a poet, a Zen Buddhist, and a writer and performer. Thank you so much for being on Between the Lines.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
When I woke up this morning, things were looking bad. Seemed like total silence was the only friend I had. A bowl of oatmeal tried to stare me down, and one knew it was 12 o'clock before I realized I was having no fun. But fortunately, I have the key to escape reality. And you may see me tonight with an illegal smile. It don't cost very much, but it lasts a long while. Won't you please tell just trying to have me some fun. The last time I checked my bankroll, it was getting thin. Sometimes it seems like the bottom is the only place I've been. I chased a rainbow down a one-way street, dead end. And all my friends turned out to be insurance salesmen. Ah, but fortunately, I have the key to escape reality. And you may see me tonight with an illegal smile. It don't cost very much, but it lasts a long while. Won't you please tell the man I didn't kill anyone? No, I'm just trying to have me some fun.
And that's it for today. Many thanks to my guest, John McInerney. And in fact, much of the music that you were listening to was chosen by him. We started off with Between the Lines, the intro music by Sarah Bareilles, followed by Oasis's version of George Harrison's Within You Without You. Then came John Lennon's Isolation and Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground's Heroine. Then I Get High on Reefer by Two Man Gentleman Band and Illegal Smile by John Prine. You've been listening to Between the Lines on WGXC at 90.7 FM. Thanks for spending time with us. I'll be back on the third Thursday in March at 2 p.m. And now, to take us out, here is Amy Winehouse and I Don't Want to Go to Rehab.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come,